Welcome to Grumpy Strategists, episode 32, the second of 2025. I'm SAA's Michael Shoebridge, and I'm joined by Strategic Analysis Australia's Head of Research, Dr. Marcus Hellyer.
Hello, Michael, and hello to all of our listeners.
We're coming to you from the Gold Coast near the new casino, which has yet to open and can still potentially be rebranded a Trump casino. So opportunities all round. Today, we've got a bit to cover. We're going to cover the first long time of the Trump administration, all 17 days.
18 days in,
aren't we? 18 days.
Yeah.
Well, probably 18 here in Australia, 17 okay. Still in America. We're also going to talk about that pesky issue of missile use against the Houthis, because we've got some real numbers out of the US Navy and some implications there for the Australian Navy. Some interesting new work by the US Congressional Budget Office, who still appear to be turning up at the office at the moment. Maybe they weren't working from home. And then some fascinating defence export. I want to say the word data, but I might say numbers
instead, call them numbers
out of the Australian Department.
Because that doesn't really say anything about their connection with reality.
Yeah. So first, 17 days in to Trump, there's some very interesting things about the Australian government's response, but also the way the Trump administration is rolling.
It's kind of exhausting keeping up, which is the strategy, of course. It is the flood the zone strategy of just keep signing executive orders to kind of swamp any potential opposition. And it does seem to be working very well. I mean, there's no way that anybody else can kind of keep up. So, yes, of course, some opposition groups, we'll call them, have filed lawsuits to stop some of these executive orders. But nobody has the resources to keep up with the executive arm of the American government, which, of course, is now controlled by Trump.
Well, I'm not sure even the executive arm can keep up with the executive arm. You look at the way different senior Trump administration appointees like Pete Hegseth in the Pentagon or Marco Rubio over at the State Department are failing to keep up with what Trump is saying about something like Gaza at the moment. You know, had Marco Rubio say, well, you know, this probably wouldn't be about displacing Palestinians. It turns out it is about displacing the Palestinians. Yeah. You had Pete Hegseth saying the military is looking at different plans for operating there and rebuilding. And then Trump comes out and says, well, there won't be any US troops there. So the rug is being pulled out from under not just leaders and companies and unions, not just in the US, but internationally. It's also being pulled out from under the feet of his own key appointees.
Which is, of course, the Trump playbook. It is the Trump playbook through and through. But when I look at America, I just look at the moment, I just go, wow, America has become this huge Karen. It is a nation of Karens, this sense of entitlement, but with
grievance
at the same time, this victimhood that everybody else in the world has taken advantage of us, and this has to stop. So it is like that Karen at the McDonald's drive-through saying, I didn't get the right drink I wanted, and throwing it in the face of this poor 17-year-old employee. And that seems to be the Trump approach to the world at the moment, which of course we know is kind of ludicrous. America is still the world's most powerful nation. Even on a per capita basis, American privilege is extraordinary. It is still has the sixth highest per capita GDP in the world. And the only countries ahead of it are not sort of normal states. They're sort of these outlier states like Switzerland and Norway. So American privilege is still extraordinary. But all of that, there's no objective kind of correlation between privilege and your perception
and how you feel. That's right.
And so that seems to be almost driving all of American policy at the moment, this view of we've been put upon, we've been exploited, and we're going to turn those things around, which of course means US abandoning global leadership. Everything Trump is doing is abandoning US global leadership.
Well, you can't be right on that, Marcus, because our Deputy Prime Minister, who I think is still also the Defence Minister, is in Washington right now. But he said some very clear things about America under the Trump administration.
So let's talk about what this means for Australia. So as we know, when organisms, animals are confronted by a threat, there's sort of three primary
responses.
Options yep. of response. There's fight, flight, and freeze. And so you've done some research on this. Which of the three characterises our government's response?
Well, I don't see any fighting. I don't see any flighting, because Plan A is AUKUS and the Alliance, and Plan B, C, D, E, and the rest of the alphabet are AUKUS and the Alliance. So there's no flight.
You don't want to fight Trump, and we're certainly not running away from Trump. No. So that leaves
freeze. And I've done some research on freezing behavior, and it starts with you're faced with a predator, a threat, which I think that's how a lot of people are actually characterizing dealing with President Trump. Mm. This rush of initiatives and ideas and actions are threatening.
Mm-hmm.
So if we consider Trump in that way, then freezing, when threatened by predators or dominant creatures, rats, mice, squirrels, and other prey species, freeze, often in a crouch, utterly devoid of movement except for breathing. And the reason they do that is predators have poor attention to things that are still and pay a lot of attention to movement. And
don't move. Don't attract the predator.
I think that's the Albanese government's approach mm-hmm. to the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. They're in a crouch, utterly devoid of movement except for breathing. So you'll hear the Prime Minister say, I don't engage in commentary.
But that has become the standard comment. And interestingly, the opposition also seems to be taking that approach as well.
Well, yeah, Peter Dutton has said a few things. Like, you know, I don't agree with him, but he said the Gaza, I can't call it a plan, set of ideas coming out of President Trump, you know, they're bold, big ideas. So at least he's acknowledged that Trump has said something. The Albanese approach is to pretend nothing's changed. So Gaza, his response is, we think there should be a two-state solution, which is something you can say regardless of what happens or hasn't happened. It's an utterly meaningless bumper sticker.
Speaking of meaningless bumper stickers, so yes, I think the Australian government has taken the freeze approach. But when it does say stuff, it's sort of characterised by an adherence to this old order, the order that Trump is deliberately overthrowing. So Miles was asked, what about Trump's threat to take over Greenland? What does Australia think about that? Well, he doesn't answer the question, but he defaults back to the term rules-based global order. In one response, he used the term rules-based global order 4 times. Well, of course, Trump, he doesn't know what a rule is. He's not interested in the globe, and he is deliberately disrupting order. So the rules-based global order is not just a meaningless term for Trump. It's everything he's setting out to overthrow. But we have the Australian government kind of rusted onto this older term because they have no other option. They have no other conception about how do we navigate our way through this new world. Well, let's just cling to this fantasy from the past. And
well, you're right. I mean, it's fascinating for Miles to say, he says things like the rules-based global order is so important to Australia and our interests. The alliance is a way of maintaining the rules-based global order. America is going to stay a powerful force for the rules-based global order in the Indo-Pacific. He says all these things. And that's his response to when somebody says, what do you think about President Trump's threat to take over Greenland and Canada by force? So that cannot be characterized as Trump maintaining the rules-based global order.
No, so when he was asked about this, the threat to Greenland, he reaffirms our adherence to the rules-based global order and says it's under pressure, and says it's clearly under pressure in Eastern Europe, code for Ukraine, and it's clearly under pressure in the Indo-Pacific, and he refers to China. Well, actually, I think the biggest threat to the rules-based global order at the moment is coming from the US, because it doesn't see that there are rules or that there is any order.
Well, I'd say the biggest new threat to the rules-based global order, because the Chinese Communist Party remains an enormous threat to the rules-based global order. But there's a new kid on the block in threatening the rules-based global order. And Trump got elected because Americans feel like the rules-based global order is code for this is how everybody, including people that call themselves our allies and friends, take advantage of us Americans.
Well, and if you were one of the many thousands of American soldiers killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, or the hundreds of thousands who have been injured or are suffering from PTSD, you can say you've got a point. But again, defaulting back to Miles, you know, He says, American leadership has underpinned the global rules-based order since the end of the Second World War. It's absolutely clear to me that we will see a continuation of that under the Trump administration. It's like, well, it's not absolutely clear to me that we're going to see a continuation of that.
Well, this is the fundamental policy problem for whoever is in government in Australia after this election. It is not clear to anybody that we're going to see the continuation of the rules-based global order under the Trump administration. Mm. Because we know this is something he actively campaigned against. And even in his early moves with things like the USAID organization, massive aid organization that underpins things like global provision of HIV medicines, anti-malaria vaccines, food security, already the dismantling is affecting that order.
Yeah, so Trump is consciously abandoning that leadership role. As you said, the USAID organization being defunded, which, by the way, is illegal. I mean, the US budget is legislation that was passed by Congress, and the administration actually has to spend it. But since the US Congress doesn't want to act as a check on Trump anymore, they're happy to go along with it.
Well, let's see what the different institutions in the US government and judiciary end up actually doing. I think your point is right that the Bannon approach of flooding the zone in a move really quickly on a huge range of fronts, be a moving target, that's very hard to deal with from legal challenge points of view, because what do you challenge when? And by the time you've succeeded, it's irrelevant anyway. But I think that Trump is in the romance part of his administration, both with Americans and other institutions of American power and internationally, because nobody wants to tell him he's doing something wrong, stupid, dangerous or damaging, because they're all worried about retribution. But this romance and the frozen mouse effect can't endure for 4 years. You cannot have the freeze response as your approach to the Trump administration for 4 years.
Well, I'm not sure about that, Michael, because we have seen many cases in history where that has been the case and the predator has been allowed to do whatever they want. And I think one of the big tests will be Trump's response to how the courts rule. So if courts rule against some of these executive orders, if they rule against them, what does Trump do? If he continues anyway and said, tough luck, I'm going to do it anyway. Well, the court, they don't have an army or a police force to arrest him.
Where's their enforcement mechanism?
He controls
the police and the military.
That will be one of the initial tests. But the other point I'd make is Trump is not just kind of sort of withdrawing from the current rules-based global order. He's not just saying, I'm going to stop funding U.S. aid, and if the Chinese move in to fill that vacuum, who cares? He's actively undermining it. So one of the latest executive orders, he signed sanctions against the International Criminal Court and the people who work at the International Criminal Court. So there is a deliberate kind of attack on the, quote, rules-based global order. And, you know, that will extend to the UN. So you're going to see the US government in open conflict with the UN.
Yes, and interestingly, you know, this thing about, well, I don't engage in commentary. Penny Wong, I think, said, well, you know, I can't comment because Trump's policy changes. Well, actually, the bones of a lot of his policies don't change. Like the idea he's going to put large tariffs on people, deport people. He sees allies as a cost. These things are actually fixed positions. The way he pursues them are different. But it's possible to actually say some things. So even the UK Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, managed to say in the British House of Commons that Gazans need to be able to live in Gaza and rebuild there, which is different to what Trump is saying. So he managed to say something which has a shred of principle to it. If Keir Starmer can do it, Anthony Albanese should be able mm-hmm. to.
Well, and the other thing is when Trump says things like remove all the Palestinians from Gaza and turn it into the Riviera of the Middle East, even if it doesn't immediately happen, it opens the aperture. So Netanyahu must be sitting there thinking, all my Hanukkahs have come at once, because here's the president of the US saying it's conceivable that you could essentially remove all of the Palestinians. And in fact, there are supporters in the US Senate who are saying, what's this West Bank stuff? Come on, let's call it what it really is, which is Judea and Samaria. But if Netanyahu says it, he goes, well, I get jumped on. The international community jumps on me. But Trump's saying it, so it opens the aperture and makes it conceivable as a course of action.
Well, you're right. It's that thing about public debate. Public debate can broaden the options for decision makers. Like we've made an argument about think tanks doing policy and analytic work here in Australia, it actually widens a public debate and gives government more room to act.
Mm-hmm. But here's Trump leading that. So
yeah, but it's interesting seeing his administration unable to keep up. So yeah, my takeaway thing here is AUKUS may be really important for regional and Australian security. But is AUKUS so important that an Australian government can take no positions that are different to the Trump administration's because of AUKUS? Is AUKUS going to be the handcuff on broader Australian foreign and national security policy?
Well, you know, people have hypothesized, well, if it is really important to us, then Trump will notice that and will turn the screws. So how important is it? Is it important enough that we'll take 200,000 Palestinian refugees from Gaza?
Well, you could see Trump does use leverage. There was a great quote, if Trump sees a bruise, he hits it. So all the warmth that we hear people like Richard Miles and Penny Wong talking about, and we had a wonderful warm telephone call. Well, now they hear about the warmth in the room at the Osmin meeting that's happening in Washington over the next day or two. Warmth doesn't matter to Trump.
Warmth ultimately doesn't matter in international relations. So I think in summary, we are still in the freeze phase. I don't think, at least publicly, the Australian government is looking at either of the two options. I don't think they'll take the fight option, but the flight option, which would entail considering plan Bs, hedging strategies, not necessarily abandoning the alliance, but looking at what can we do to mitigate the impact of the US not being a global leader anymore. I mean, we don't see any sign of that yet.
Well, call me a heretic, but I think we should be hedging. And I think other American close allies are already hedging. I think this is why the Japanese government offered their frigate, the Megami-class frigate, to Australia for the General Purpose Frigate Program, because mm-hmm. they see Australia as an important enough partner that it can help hedge, given the uncertainties of America and the dangers of China.
Okay, so we're talking about my happy place, which is capability. We've got some updates that have happened over the last month or so. So Megami is an interesting one. We have argued a number of times that we should be looking at C-3000, the General Purpose Frigate Program, is not just a military capability, but part of a broader strategic relationship Ooh. With Japan. And we've suggested one of the key advantages the Japanese have in their competition with Germany for this program is that the Japanese have an existing production line. There are frigates under construction for the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force. One of the key advantages they have is they could actually offer Australia frigates already on that production line intended cool. for their own Navy.
Yep.
But they could actually say, well, we're not going to wait until 2029 to give you a frigate. We'll give you the next one that comes off the production line. And it's interesting that the Japanese themselves have now said this. So,
well, it wasn't just a Japanese civilian official. It was a Japanese admiral. And you know, when an admiral is saying, you can have one of the ships that was meant for me, that is a very mm-hmm. big deal. Mm-hmm.
So I think that's quite big news. Also, what have we got? We've gotten numbers from the US Navy. So unlike our Navy and our Defence Force, the US give out real information. And they've actually given out information on how much ordnance they've used in the Red Sea against the Houthis.
Can you imagine the Royal Australian Navy even having a glimmer of a thought of releasing use of missile numbers? Well, I can think of one big reason they wouldn't, which is they don't have many. So any number would be tiny, but they just...
Plus, they've never actually used one. Well, I don't think we've ever fired an air defence missile in anger.
They celebrated the test firing, so I suppose they admitted using one SM-6. But this again gets back to that point about it's possible to run a highly secure military with secret, top secret and other classified information and release information to the public about things like how many missiles you've fired off against the Houthis. So what are the numbers and what do they tell us?
Well, the numbers are very interesting. So the total number is over 400 munitions.
Over what period are we talking?
We are 15 months.
Right.
1¼ years. So 120 SM-2 missiles, so they're a long-range air defence missile.
Which the Australian Navy has.
Which the Australian Navy has. 80 SM-6 missiles, which are an even more capable, kind of over-the-horizon long-distance air defence missiles.
Multi-million dollar a piece,
I think about 6 to 7 million US a pop, so 10 million Australian a pop. We apparently, one of the big news items from last year was that apparently our Hobart-class frigates can now use that, the missile. It's not clear we actually have any in stock, but separate issue. 160 rounds from the 5-inch main gun, so cheap and cheerful old-fashioned
artillery shells. Yep, the old ways are best. Yep.
And then a combined 20 Evolved Sea Sparrow missiles, which are sort of the short-range air defence missiles, and SM-3 missiles, which are the super-duper expensive missiles used for shooting down
anti-ballistic missiles.
Ballistic missiles.
Yeah, yeah.
So what is really interesting in that is that the bulk of the missile use, so 200 missiles, are those very expensive long-range missiles, SM-2 and SM-6. Only 20 are either ESSM or SM-3. That's very bad news for Australia, and the reason for that is our Anzac class frigates, which are still the core of our surface
fleet, the warfighting surface fleet,
and will remain so because we have three Hobart destroyers and seven in service Anzacs. The Anzacs only have ESSM. So when I look at those numbers, I'm going, okay, the American Navy, when they see missiles coming, they don't sit back and say, well, our short-range missiles, which
it's
we have
close
lots
enough
of
now, so I won't use an ESSM. I'm waiting until it's close enough so I can use the ESSM.
It's like we're going to take that missile out a long way away, and we're going to use our long-range expensive missiles to do that. And then you go, all right, okay, good, fine, you've got lots of missiles, lots of money, you can do that. We don't even have that option because we don't have those long-range missiles on the Anzacs.
You see, I don't think the American captain is deciding to be profligate with weapons and money.
No.
I think this is an extremely rational calculation. It's a deeply mathematical decision. And the mathematics is the probability of killing the incoming missile or drone.
Correct.
And the problem is the mathematics says each interceptor you have has a less than 100% chance of killing the incoming missile. And if you don't kill it,
probability of kill.
If you don't kill it, it kills you. So to say I've got a 95% probability of hitting it, that is not a basis for only firing an ESSM if it was that higher probability. Mm-hmm. You need a layered system, and you must use your longer range ones as part of that, because otherwise the probability curve means the Houthis will eventually kill you.
Yeah. No, so the US, the captain of that US destroyer is not going, gosh, how do I save money? He's not going, gosh, if I fire two of these SM-2s, it's going to cost $20 million. He's thinking, I want to save my ship and my crew. And in fact, that's what they've been told to do. That is their doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
So the doctrine in air defense is shoot, shoot, look. So you fire two missiles and see what the effect was, whether you destroyed the incoming threat.
Mm-hmm.
And if you haven't destroyed it, you shoot again. You can do that with an SM-2 or SM-6 because of their range.
Gives you
time. You can't actually do that with ESSM because you don't have enough time to respond because the threat is so close. So with ESSM, the doctrine kind of defaults to shoot, 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 until the missile either hits you.
Well, you've got to get the probability of kill up,
or you know it for sure it's gone. So, but it also, it kind of points to the fact that our surface fleet is now irrelevant.
Yeah, well, if it can't be secure against the Houthis, then it's an ineffective naval warfighting capability. That's what it tells you. And those figures tell you that if you don't have large numbers of SM-2s and SM-6s, you can't be floating around anywhere the Houthis want to do you harm.
Yeah.
And the Houthis aren't the biggest threat on the planet. There's a bigger one in the Indo-Pacific that keeps bumping into Australian ships.
Correct. So that's all a bit depressing. What to me it does say is that whoever wins the general purpose frigate contest, it has to have SM-2 and SM-6.
Yeah, and celebrating the ESSM and saying we're installing that on the general purpose frigate would mean we couldn't use that ship against the Houthis or many other people.
We are, by the way, in a cooperative program with the US and a number of other countries to upgrade the ESSM and buy large numbers of more modern versions of it. But the problem seems to be it's not actually a frontline capability. It's your absolute fallback capability. But on most of our ships, we don't actually have that cutting edge, long range capability.
Well, mind you, the other thing this number tells me, you know, 400 munitions, okay, 160 of those are 5-inch gun rounds, but the rest are exotic, expensive missiles. The basic economics is really bad here for the US Navy, because the Houthi offensive systems are cheap and cheerful, and the American response is exotic and expensive, and you cannot resupply the fleet fast enough to not be overwhelmed if you're facing an adversary that has decent volumes of these cheap offensive systems. So the bigger problem is even a well-equipped US Navy is still at a disadvantage.
So you go, all right, 100 SM-2s, 80 SM-6s, 200 missiles combined. So maybe we're looking at $2 billion. And you go, well, that if that's saving a multi-billion-dollar destroyer, it's not a bad investment. The problem is you're going to run out of those missiles regardless of the price if you're up against an adversary.
Well, if you're fighting a peer adversary rather than the Houthis, you've got a big problem. That's what it tells you.
Yep.
So another thing that came out of the US, the Congressional Budget Office still at work under the new Trump administration. Well, this report, I think, came out in the last days of Biden.
See, fortunately, the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, Congressional Research Office, they actually work for Congress, so they're essentially protected by Congress. So hopefully they will continue to function.
Up to a point, Lord Copper, is what I'd say. But yes, they put out a fascinating report which did some actual numbers around different AUKUS scenarios. So, you know, does the US give Acelus 3 or 5 Virginias? Does it replace all of them? There were 3 scenarios. And I think making AUKUS a bit of a fact-grounded discussion rather than an emotional one about big hats and jobs is very wise. So what were the scenarios?
So, well, the scenarios are about... Scenario one is they give us 3 Virginias or sell us 3 Virginias. Mm-hmm. The second one is that it will be 5, presumably because building Snorkus is delayed.
Snorkus is slow, which I think Snorkus will be. Yep.
So those are the first 2 options of the 3 and the 5. And the third one, and they don't replace them.
Okay,
in a sense, they don't build replacements. They sort of suck it up.
Yep.
They don't change their building capacity. Yep. Of course, that leads to a shortfall in US submarine numbers. Okay, you sell somebody some of your existing submarines, don't replace them, you're going to have a shortfall.
Yep.
What to me is really interesting is option 3, which is where they sell us 5 boats and they build replacements.
So this plan is based on they raise their submarine production capacity to that magical 2.33 boats per annum, which they so far have shown no capacity to reach.
They're still stuck at 1.2.
But the scenario is based on that happening. Right, okay.
But even if they manage to get to 2.3, they will still have a shortfall. And they would, so to quote it, in that case, the Navy would still have fewer attack submarines for 20 years from 2032 to 2052 than it would have under its 2025 plan. So essentially what it's currently forecasting. So essentially, even if they build replacements, it's going to result in a capability shortfall for the US Navy.
Now, each nuclear attack submarine, I think you get about 6 months for every 2 years of life. You get 6 months of it being operational if the maintenance is not backlogged. And at the moment, maintenance is backlogged. So is that right? So
broadly averaged over the fleet.
Every 2 years of ownership, you get 6 months of operational use for a nuclear attack submarine. So that means for 4 years of ownership, you get 1 year of operational use. So how many years of operational use does the American Navy lose even if they replace the submarines that they sell us?
40.
40 operational.
They lose 40 operational years, which is essentially the equivalent of 160 years of ownership of boats. So it's a real impact on the US Navy, even if they build replacements. So that is rather disturbing.
Ooh.
Again, you know, that by itself doesn't mean the US won't provide us with submarines, but it does flesh out what AUKUS actually means, the impact on the US Navy.
Well, it stops it being about emotion and, you know, being a century of mateship, and it's the real cost to the American military of selling us those submarines. Well, that'll be interesting if that factual material informs the discussion and debate in any way. Some information that doesn't look quite so factual is the recently released Australian Defence Department's defence export figures for the year.
So as we know, Australia has a robust export control regime, though key elements are going to change under AUKUS. Australian companies won't need export permits if they're exporting to the US or the UK general.
But right now they need permits. So if a company wants to export something, they have to apply. And the unfortunate thing is whether the sale does or doesn't happen, the value of the export permit is the only thing that our defence bureaucrats collect.
Correct. So when a company applies for an export permit, they can voluntarily declare a value in of that export. They don't have to. Generally, they do. So normally, sort of 90-ish, 9 to 95% of permits state a value. But that's the only information we have from the Australian government or the Australian Defence Department on the value of Australian defence exports. And sort of over the last decade, that permit value has sort of varied from a bit over $1 billion up to about $5 billion.
Per annum. Yep.
Again, those are not actual sales, but simply the self-assessed value.
So if every sale had happened, that would have been $5 billion in that year, potentially.
Potentially, yes. So it's sort of swung backwards and forwards. What is really interesting is that last year, so 22-23, that self-assessed value went up over $15 billion.
From 5 to 15, wow.
From 5 to 15, quite an increase. And noting, however, that the number of permits remain pretty standard. So it's not like we tripled the number of permits to reach that triple number. What is truly amazing.
Historic.
I mean, you could call it historic or flabbergasting. I'm not quite sure which.
Yep.
The number for 23-24, pick a number, Michael. Pick a number.
Well, 15, that's a big number, up from 5. So I'm going to go 30. I'm going to double it. 30 billion.
Keep going.
We're going to double that.
Double that.
60 billion.
No, keep going.
120 billion.
103 billion.
Wow. Isn't that, what a success. Why have we not heard about this from Minister Conroy or Deputy Prime Minister Richard Miles?
Considering, you know, they were happy to announce, you know, a $15 million sale, the fact that we haven't heard anything about $103 billion in potential Aussie industry sales overseas is a little strange.
Well, I can think of one reason. It'd make the US unhappy because we're eating their lunch. Where we'd be almost the number two arms exporter globally.
It would make
us
the number two arms exporter in the world.
Yeah, with only America to overtake.
So,
you know what I think? I think this number bears no resemblance to reality. And
what? I think that can't be the case.
The fact that the Defense Department keeps publishing these numbers shows they don't want real data. Because whenever you hear them talk about these numbers, they explain how they're meaningless because it's just a permit value. It's nothing about the sales. It's actually in their interest to have gibberish out in the public domain because they can wax lyrical about how it doesn't mean anything.
I mean, it is pure gibberish. I will give you that. You would have to sort of look out across Australia and go, every family is sitting around their dining table assembling killer drones, like is the case in Ukraine. Where $103 billion in industrial activity.
I talk to a lot of defence industry types. They tell me they're on the bones of their bums.
Yes.
They're getting no work from the Australian government and they're not crowing about massive export sales. This would say defence industry in Australia is like NVIDIA. That's just had amazing success. And I don't believe it.
So if people think that maybe we're being too cynical, we do have a couple of other sources of data on Australian defence exports. One is the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Their number for 23-24 is 417 million.
Oh, I thought you were going to say billion. I thought we'd had even more success.
So it's about 0.5% of the Defence Export Control Office's number. And then DFAT takes the ABS numbers and adjusts them a bit, and they've come up with 267 million. So a quarter of a billion. So that's the DECO number's 400 times
bigger.
Either
the ABS and DFAT are committing gross negligence, or the Defence Export Office number is absolute gibberish. And my vote is for that that last one. So what we need to have is proper export data for defence. And so defence officials need to stop explaining why their numbers are meaningless and collect real numbers.
Correct.
So there are some real numbers to be had.
There's actually some good capability news. So we often sit here being very critical, but, you know, we should also give out the good news. And the first big piece of good news is my baby.
Yes.
The offshore patrol vessel. I feel a sense of ownership for that, because essentially that is the offspring of the 2009 white paper and the supporting force structure review, which I was involved in. And that was the first time this kind of concept came up. So I sort of feel a sense of ownership.
This was build something that was already in service and don't change it much.
Well, the idea was not to replace the patrol boats, the mine hunters and the hydrographic ships with separate classes of vessels, but to get a sort of bigger multi-role vessel. Now, of course, it hasn't turned out that way, but I still feel that the intellectual underpinnings of the Arafura OPV go back to the 2009 white paper.
Finally,
the first one has been handed over by industry to the Australian Defence Department.
It's great to hear someone who wants to take ownership and be proud of the offshore patrol vessel, which is a debacle in plain sight, but nothing like the level of debacle of the Hunter frigate. Interestingly, the strategic review from Angus Houston and Stephen Smith, which seems so long ago, said the Navy should cancel the offshore patrol vessels or reduce the build. You know, there were six already in build, should buy no more. There was no good purpose for these. The Navy needed to think about what it might use them for. And the original purpose was kind of constabulary, border control, immigration, and Pacific engagement.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'd be interested to know, did the Navy listen to that advice that those purposes weren't sufficient, and has it found a good use for them? What purpose is the new Arafura that's been accepted into service have?
Well, according to this defence media release, it will be part of the wider Navy minor war vessel fleet supporting civil maritime security and enhanced regional engagement in the Southwest Pacific and maritime Southeast Asia.
Right, so it's going to be doing exactly what defence planned it was going to be doing before the strategic review said that was a bad idea.
Yes, yes. So the other interesting term here is it's described as part of the minor war vessel fleet, but the surface fleet review said it had no conceivable warfighting purpose. But putting that aside, the first one has arrived. I will somewhat snarkily say that IMR, initial material release, was originally scheduled for December 2021, so we're 37 months late, but hey, what's 37 months between friends? We've got the first one. It's being handed over. And I will say that it is the actual first ship to come out of the previous government's 2017 shipbuilding plan. So we're meant to be getting the French submarines. We're meant to be getting the future frigate, which is, you know, the Hunter debacle, and we'll get the OPV. So here we are. We've gotten the first actual ship.
The first of a now cancelled order. Yes, yes. And Defence, in its tried and true fashion, is ignoring external direction to change and is insisting on using them for the purpose they originally intended against the direction of the strategic review. But they will be completely shameless about all of that.
Well, maybe, except on that issue of fatherless children, I would note that this media release is from the Department of Defence. The person quoted is the Deputy Secretary of Shipbuilding and Sustainment. No minister wants to touch this. No minister wants to touch this.
Ooh. So there were a couple of other announcements, which actually were some little dribbles of money for Australian companies. I think there's one about the SIPAC drone purchase that's now going to come with some Australian radios. That's good news.
Yeah, so there is some good news here for Aussie SMEs. So if we recall, middle of last year, the government announced it was spending $100 million to acquire two classes of drones. One of them was the Quantum Systems Vector 2-in-1, which I believe is a German drone, unfortunately not an Australian company. The other one is the SIPAC Systems Corvo X. So SIPAC is an Australian company with a long heritage of autonomous systems. You'll recall they The cardboard drone into the Ukraine. No, this is not the cardboard drone. So recently we had an announcement of $15 million going to, I believe, an Adelaide company to provide networked radios to go into those SIPAC drones. So, you know, trickle of money going to local Australian companies. I just note that companies.
$15 million wouldn't be worth a press release in most cases. $15 million isn't enough to buy 1.5 SM-6 missiles.
You got to start somewhere, I suppose. I'm trying to be optimistic.
Well, look, I'll raise your 15.
Yes, what have you got?
To 61.5.
And what's that going on?
Well, I was sitting down when I saw this, and that's lucky, because it's something from the Advanced Strategic Capability Accelerator.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't $60 million for 20 institutions, mainly universities, which I'd seen earlier. This 61.5 is to actual companies
for
systems relevant to air and missile defence. One's in Brisbane and one is in Adelaide.
So what are they? What are we getting?
Well, we can't know that because for security reasons, we can't even know the companies. So the Americans can tell us the numbers of missiles they've fired and the types of missiles they've fired, and we know who made them. But our government and our Defence Department won't even tell us the name of two Australian companies they've given 1-year contracts to, valued at $61.5 million in total.
Oh, well, I mean, we can't seek perfection, I guess. So at least two Aussie companies out there are getting $60 million to build stuff, which, again, good start, so well done. Congratulations to them, whoever
and also
may be.
Well done to the Defence officials who've come up with a name for an Australian manufactured autonomous system that isn't Ghost something. So I was thinking they did Ghost Shark, Ghost Cat must have been coming our way, but they've come up with Blackthorn.
Blackthorn.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah, which I thought was a Netflix series, but it's actually this. Okay. Look, it's been a long time since the last podcast because that was just at the time of the ending of the Biden administration. Mm. And I can't even remember who Joe Biden was now.
Who? Joe who?
Before we go, though, I'd just like to remind the listener that we'll be at the ADM annual conference here in Canberra. What's that date again, Marcus?
The 19th of February.
Yep.
So we'll be doing a live show of the Grumpy Strategist.
Yeah, so get to the conference, listen to the officials, listen to the ministers telling us about their historic, amazing progress and their pursuit of the rules-based global order, and then we can be your after-lunch entertainment.
Sounds great.
Thanks, everyone.